You know, as we begin our talk today, I want you to think about a gate. And now I know that a gate is probably something that you don't think about a lot, unless you're Jerry who puts up fences for a living. Gates probably are not on your mind day to day, right? However, I found myself a few months ago with a gate being the first thing on my mind at 6 a.m. in the morning. I'm sitting there drinking my cup of coffee, and I should back up. So we just moved into a new place in June, and it's an older place, and the fence is showing some signs of wear and tear, and it needs to be replaced sometime in the next couple of years, but we figured we had a little bit of time. So I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking my cup of coffee, and all of a sudden, Mel comes into the room, and she's holding the phone like this. She's like, "Joe, you need to see this." And it's a picture of our dog, Scout, out among the town, just living his best life. And he had, there's our dog Scout right there, if you haven't met him. So that is our 100-pound puppy, okay? He's 1 year old this week, actually. But he is a big boy. And I think he felt a little too constricted in our backyard, and so he took all of that and he rammed the gate down. Just completely demolished our gate and was out, you know, gallivanting through the streets of Ladysmith, just living his best life. Needless to say, we're getting our fence replaced this spring, but I just had to share this picture with you. Because we don't think about the importance of a gate until you need one. And as we continue to explore Jesus on his own terms, we're going to take a look at his third formal I am statement. Jesus made 7 formal I am statements in the Gospel of John, and these statements are structured in such a way that they're declarations of Jesus' divine status as the Son of God. The phrase I am, or in the Greek, ego eimi, literally I am, is on itself doesn't really mean much. It's, you know, if I was being formal, I said, "Hi, my name is Joe," you know, I would say ego eimi. But the way that Jesus structures these statements, it is a clear indicator of what he's referring to. Ego eimi was how God refers to himself in the book of Isaiah. It's how he introduced himself to Moses in the burning bush. And Jesus pairs these I am statements with a description about his identity that is unmistakably something that only God can do. Our first week we looked at, I am the bread of life. Jesus is the nourishment for our souls. Last week was, I am the light of the world. Jesus is the righteous judge that exposes our hearts and leads us into the path of life. And today Jesus' statement is, I am the gate. Now, I don't know about you, but I was really excited about the bread of life. The light of the world, like, that's just a powerful statement. And then you have the gate. What does a gate do? You know, it's not like a door, with, you know, a big, heavy door. It's a gate, and it opens, and it closes. If you haven't looked after it, maybe it squeaks. You know, it just doesn't seem that exciting. Especially because it appears next to Jesus' next I am statement, which we'll look at next week, which is, I am the good shepherd. And that's a great one. The good shepherd, that's a statement. Jesus is the protector and the caregiver and all of the things that go along there. There's a relationship there. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, because that's next week. But a gate. Well, let's reserve judgment until we hear Jesus describe himself on his own terms, because that's what this series is all about. So we're going to take a look at John chapter 10. We're going to start in verse 1. John 10, verse 1. I tell you the truth. Anyone who sneaks over the wall of a sheepfold, rather than going through the gate, must surely be a thief and a robber. But the one who enters through the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep recognize his voice and come to him. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. After he has gathered his own flock, he walks ahead of them, and they follow him because they know his voice. They won't follow a stranger. They will run from him because they don't know his voice. Those who heard Jesus use this illustration didn't understand what he meant. It's good to know we're not alone. So he explained it to them. I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. All who came before me were thieves and robbers, but the true sheep did not listen to them. Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved. They will come and go freely and find good pastures. The thief's purpose is to steal and kill and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life. Like everything else in the Gospel of John, Jesus' illustration is not a standalone event. It's actually very closely tied to Jesus' statement before, I am the light of the world, and very closely tied to the one that comes after, I am the good shepherd. After Jesus declared that he was the light of the world, he proves this claim by healing a man born blind. He does this incredible enacted parable. He says, I'm the light of the world. And he goes out, he finds a man who's born blind, and he heals him so he can see. And the crazy thing is how the Pharisees respond to the miraculous work of God. They respond with skepticism. They respond by berating the man for being healed on the Sabbath. And so they do an inquiry where they call him in and they call in his parents and they're quizzing him and they're asking him about his experience with Jesus. It's an interrogation. And it was clear that the man was born blind and now he could see. But because he believed in Jesus, they ended up expelling him from the synagogue. They cast him out of the synagogue. Now the synagogue was the local house of worship. It was similar to a church. And so being cast out of the synagogue was not just a rejection of the man from the religious gathering, it was rejection from community. Especially because, unlike us, there was no separation of church and state. Judaism's governance was inseparable from its belief in God. And so being expelled from the synagogue was a disgrace in the community. They kicked him out. And in response, Jesus turns the tables on the Pharisees by turning their own verdict on its head. Jesus paints this picture of a walled sheepfold. And while shepherding might be a little bit foreign to us, the type of sheepfold that Jesus is talking about is not a commercial sheepfold. It's not a place where there's thousands of sheep and there's an owner and all kinds of things going on. It's a familial sheepfold. It's close and intimate. It's a community. Not much like the community of the synagogue. So it's owned by a local family. So Jesus paints this picture. And the backdrop of this is the prophet Ezekiel referred to the people of Israel as God's sheep. And the leaders of Israel he referred to as their shepherds. And Ezekiel chapter 34 lays down some important context that we're going to look at more closely next week. But for now, all we need to know is that Jesus is the gate, the Pharisees are the robbers, and the sheep are the people of God. And so in this illustration, it's not the once blind man who is out of community, but the Pharisees, the thieves and the robbers, trying to scale the walls and lead the sheep astray, are the ones who are not welcomed in. It's not the man who's been kicked out of the family of God, but the Pharisees. Oh, could you imagine, you know, you're a Pharisee and you just said, hey man, you're out of the community, and then Jesus just turns the tables on you like that. All of a sudden, this gate imagery makes sense. The Pharisees judged about who was in and who was out, and Jesus challenges their self-appointed authority by declaring that he alone opens and closes, welcoming whomever he will welcome, and refusing all he will refuse. The Pharisees have no spiritual authority, and Jesus has the ultimate authority. Let's dig a little bit deeper on Jesus' phrase, his statement that he is the gate. The first point this morning is that Jesus is the gate that provides security. Jesus is the gate that provides security. In 2015, a news headline reads this: 450 Turkish sheep leap to their deaths. This is a true story. I looked. There are several different reputable news sources covered this story. Apparently, 1,500 sheep hurled themselves over a cliff for no apparent reason. Now, thankfully, only the first 450 died, because the other sheep, they padded the fall so the sheep behind them survived. And I know this is a sad story, okay? But just like the picture of a sheep flying through the air and landing on a pile of other sheep and bouncing gracefully off, I can't get that image out of my mind. But it's actually a very tragic story. It cost many families to lose their only source of income. And you would have assumed that, you know, you have this pasture, you would have assumed you didn't need a fence along the cliff, but apparently it wouldn't have been a bad idea. When we think about a gate, the main purpose of a gate in both the first century when Jesus was speaking and now is security. Now, while the story of the sheep jumping off of a cliff like lemmings is an anomaly, there are lots of dangers outside the sheepfold. There's wolves, there's thieves. I grew up in the prairies, and you're often shooting gophers because cows or sheep or whatever will step in the holes and their legs will break, right? There's a lot of dangers out there for sheep, and they're prone to wander. They're prone to just kind of like, go wherever they please, like not on much like scout. And in Jesus' illustration, we are the sheep, and we have much more in common with sheep than we care to admit. First of all, we are all very familiar with the derogatory term sheeple, right? It refers to our herd mentality, where we find safety in a herd. I mean, that's what sheep do. Sheep find safety in numbers. And often we look at what the broader culture is or what broader movements, and we see what other people are doing, and we attach ourselves to that. And and the fallacy is we think, if there's this many people doing it, it must be a good idea. It must be safe. It must be the right thing. Everyone else is doing it, so I'm going to do it too. And so we are herd people. It's a fallacy. If the herd is jumping off a cliff, there is not safety in numbers. And in society, sometimes I wonder if we're just hurling ourselves off of a cliff to see what is going to happen. But it's also important to understand that the idea of needing a herd isn't completely negative. We're communal beings. The sheep of Jesus find security within the boundaries of God's love. We need one another. We weren't meant to be on our own. So we're like sheep in that we're communal beings. The second way that we're like sheep is that we're a little bit stubborn. I think that Scout is a sheep, hiding in dog's clothing. Like we took him to training at PetSmart, and he's come a long way, but his recall, I mean, that's the worst. And it's not that he doesn't know how to do recall. He knows. He knows how to do recall. He has come when I've called him thousands of times. But if he does not want to come, it's not that he doesn't hear me, it's that he's not listening. In the same way, sheep are pretty stubborn. And we will often persist in sin, even though we know we are wrong. Even though we know what we are doing is destructive, even though we know it's hurting us or it's hurting other people, we will just continue to do that. Anyone ever got into an argument with their spouse halfway through and you realized you were wrong? No, none of you raised your hand because you're too stubborn to admit it. Case in point. And the same is true of our spirituality. So often we go so far in one direction, we're too stubborn to admit that we're wrong. and we won't turn around. So we're like sheep in that we have a herd mentality, we're stubborn, and finally, we're prone to wander. The grass is always greener, even when it's not. Desire is an unquenchable flame. The person who has everything still desires what they do not have, even if they don't know what that is. In the Bible, King Solomon said, "You know, you've burned eternity on our hearts. There's this desire for something that's unquenchable." And so do our hearts wander from God's goodness, seeking greener pastures even when there are none. But here's the good news. For all of the people who can admit to the fact that they're stubborn, wandering sheeple, Jesus is the gate that leads to eternal security. In verse 9 he says, "Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved." In Jesus, we are eternally secure. We are secure from the sin that leads to death. I remember growing up in church, and my story is not that much different from many of yours if you grew up in church. And I kind of had this idea that you could wander in and out of faith. If you had a bad day, you could lose your salvation. So I don't know how many times I said the sinner's prayer. Like, it must have been hundreds of times that, you know, every eye closed, every head bowed, you know, raise your hand to receive Jesus. Because I was so fearful that I'd somehow fallen out of God's grace. But in Jesus, we are eternally secure. Jesus doesn't stop being the gate when we have a bad day. His love is far, far greater than that. And on the other side of Jesus, we find true freedom. Jesus is the gate that opens to freedom. The gate provides security, but unlike the rest of the fence, it also provides an access in and out. And these words come immediately following Jesus' statement, "Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved. They will come and go freely and find good pasture." So first we're given a picture of security, and then we're given a picture of freedom. And that's really fascinating if you think about it for more than 3 seconds, because the two of them are polar opposites. You know, if you want freedom, you're going to have to sacrifice security. If you want security, you're going to have to sacrifice freedom. Right? Think about freedom as it's broadly defined by our culture. The ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. What a great nonsensical statement. And I'm going to break it down. Why it's nonsense. Part A, the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. Okay, that makes sense. That is the definition of freedom. Absolutely. I could say, you know, is this freedom? Yes, that is one definition of freedom. But then when you tag B on to that, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone, well, as soon as you add a criteria, any criteria at all, to that first statement, you've completely negated the whole thing and it folds in on itself. Because if you're free to do whatever you want, whenever you want, but then there's limits, well, then you're not really free to do whatever it you want, whenever you want. And so why put limits on freedom? Because freedom defined as doing whatever you want, whenever you want it, leads to anxiety, it leads to harm, it leads to destruction both in yourself and to those around you, it leads to chaos, and ultimately it leads to death. The joy of freedom is quickly overshadowed by the pain it causes. And even the world understands this, even though they would deny it, freedom without limits leads to destruction. And so the question is, how does Jesus define freedom? Freedom under Jesus. That's how he defines it. Freedom under himself. The sheep listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd. They come and go freely as they follow him. See, the freedom, the boundaries are provided by the gate. They come and go through Jesus. They follow Jesus, the Good Shepherd. And they're led to where the grass is greener. They're led to where there's life and where there's freedom. See, by definition, security and freedom are polar opposites. But in Jesus, they go hand in hand. How can this be? Because Jesus is the gate. He opens to freedom and closes for security. Let's look at it maybe a different way. The very reason that freedom appeals to us is that all of us desire the freedom to pursue what we love. What good is freedom if you can't use it to pursue what you love? And our loves make us who we are. Timothy Keller, who was a pastor in New York, and he's a prolific writer, he writes this: what makes people into what they are is the order of their loves, what they love most, more, less, and least. This is more fundamental to who you are than even the beliefs to which you mentally subscribe to. Your loves show that what you actually believe in, not what you say you do. People, therefore, change not by merely changing their thinking, but by changing what they love most. To follow Jesus is to love Him the most. It's to allow Him to change you and to reorder your loves so that He is on the top. And then you have the freedom to pursue Him, because that's what your heart truly desires. And because you are in Him, you have complete and total eternal security. Only in Jesus can you have freedom and security together. Otherwise, there's always a give and take. Now, you might be thinking, you know, that's awful self-serving of Jesus. You know, to reorder our loves, to reorder our desires in such a way that it puts Him on the very top. Well, friends, you might be surprised to find that making Him the very top of the pursuit of our affections is the most selfless thing of all. Because Jesus is the gate that leads to the way. Jesus said, "All who came before me were thieves and robbers, but the true sheep did not listen to them. Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved." Once again, as with Jesus' other I am statements, we are confronted with the offensively radical exclusiveness of Jesus' claim. He didn't say, "I am a snack of life." He didn't say, "I am a light." He doesn't say, "I am a gate." He says, "I am the gate." The idea of one passageway, one route in and out of anywhere is completely foreign to us. I was trying to think of some of the most remote places in BC, and I was thinking of Powell River because you can't access it by land. But even then, there's more than one way in or out of Powell River. You can go by boat or you can go by air. And then if you look at either of those two ways, there's a whole plethora of options within that. You could take a ferry. You could take a different ferry. You could take a private boat. You could take a commercial airline. You could take a charter. You could even bring a helicopter. There's nothing but options. And we like options. We like choices. And so when it comes to faith, we say, why can't I have the choices? Why can't I pick and choose however I want to get to God, however I want to get to this rich and flourishing life? Why can't I just pick and choose how I get there? You can do that with everything else. But you can't do that when it comes to spiritual life. There's only one gate. We love options, especially in our Canadian way of thinking. And in case there's any doubt about there being one way, Jesus says, "All who came before me were thieves and robbers." a saying that Leon Morris calls strangely comprehensive. It's just so broad, it's kind of weird. Because when you think about the thieves and the robbers in this text, the immediate application is to the Pharisees. Right? They're the ones who are trying to lead the people of Israel astray. And so Jesus says, look, if you're looking for life, if you're looking for a relationship with God, and you're following these guys, good luck. It's not going to work out. But he doesn't just say, these guys who came before me. He says, all who came before me. Okay, so what else would that mean? Well, they lived, like us, they lived in a very pluralistic society. There was a lot of polytheism, a lot of belief in different gods, and it wasn't uncommon, again, because we like to choose, to pick and choose your gods and what you wanted to follow. And Jesus says, all of those are thieves and robbers. Okay, wow, that's intense. So you're saying the strictest sect in all of Judaism, Pharisees, is the wrong way. And you're saying the most liberal possible way to achieve the good life is wrong. But it's still quite not broad enough. All who came before. Well, who came before Jesus? Prophets? And the big one, Moses. Is Jesus calling the prophets and Moses thieves and robbers? You got to be careful here, because Jesus isn't talking about them in a derogatory way. He's not saying they were, you know, scoundrels like the Pharisees were. What he is saying is that if you are looking for life, you're not going to find it in the prophets. You're not going to find it in the law of Moses. You're going to find it in me. What does Jesus say? He says, yes, I am the gate. Those who come through me will be saved. So if you look anywhere else to be saved, you're in trouble. So why is Jesus so strangely and so strongly, so passionately comprehensive? Is it because he's hosting some kind of exclusive VIP access club called heaven, where only a select few are allowed to enter, and too bad for everyone else? You need to understand the reason that Jesus is so radically exclusive is not because he's creating some kind of special VIP club. The reason that Jesus is so radically exclusive is for the simple fact that life cannot be found anywhere else. See, Jesus isn't being exclusive just to be a jerk. He's saying, look, you can go and look. You can search the world over. You want to know the way to life? It's through me. Through the gate. You can try. Many have. But it's just not anywhere else. Jesus alone is the gateway to life. If he could offer it to us another way, I believe that he would. But he cannot, for he alone is life. A statement that is made abundantly clear in the last verse, verse 10. The thief's purpose is to steal and kill and destroy. My purpose is to give life, is to give them a rich and satisfying life. Now, typically, when I was growing up, I would read this verse, or when I heard this verse preached, the thief was always the devil. That was, you know. And I think that's a pretty solid translation. That's pretty good. If you follow, you know, all of the conclusions down the path far enough, you're going to end up there. But if we want to be a little bit more accurate about what Jesus is saying, let's bring it back into our immediate context. Let's bring it back to something that's a little bit less abstract. See, the devil is the father of all lies. He leads us away from God. But if we want to be more accurate about how Jesus has defined the word thief in this passage, the thief is anyone or anything that leads you away from him. Anyone or anything that tries to tell you that life is found outside of him. Here are some thieves in our modern world. Endless distractions. Hurry. The tyranny of the urgent. Believing that you're saved by being a good person. Faith in other religions or the great atheist religion of secularism. The thief is what robs you of the rich and satisfying life that is only found in Jesus. The word for rich and satisfying, or a lot of translations say abundant life, is the word perissos. It means over and above, abundant, overflowing, excessive. If I could ask one question of you this morning, is how would you describe your life? Is it overflowing? Is it abundant? Is it excessively full of hope and joy and love and faith? See, Jesus offers an open invitation into the abundant life of human flourishing, both now and forever. But you have to walk through the gate. You can't sit on the fence contemplating what you're going to do. You can't try to clamber over it by earning your way like the Pharisees thought that they could, trying to get there on their own strength and their own intellect and their own abilities. There's only one way in and one way out. Jesus is the gate that opens to true freedom. It cannot be found anywhere else if it is simply not there. I'm going to invite the band to come on up. You know, as we were worshiping, I had a little bit of an image come to my mind. I wanted to share this till the last, because it's not really a good exegesis of this passage, but it fits in really well with what I'm talking about. I had this picture of a wall, and I was bumping up against this wall, and I couldn't get through. And I really felt like that represents just this being stuck and waiting for breakthrough, waiting for God to do something, you're just stuck. You just keep smashing your head against this wall and nothing's happening. And then in this picture, a few feet over was a gate. And is that so off? That was really sudden, out of nowhere there. But is that not? I'll wait. We'll just wait till everyone recovers. So there's a wall, hitting the wall. And then a few feet over, there's a gate. And I just felt like Jesus was saying, I'm right here. Stop. Just stop it. Stop trying to do it on your own. Stop trying to live life on your own. Stop trying to make it work on your own. Stop trying to push your way through and to put your head down and just be man enough for whatever it is. Humble yourself. Take a few steps over and walk through Jesus. Because in Him is life. Dear Heavenly Father, we hold our lives open before You. God, we want to repent of the time when we've wandered, when we've followed the crowd, when we've been distracted, when we've been stubborn. But Jesus, let us walk through the gate. Let us walk through You. Let us not try to do it on our own or make it on our own. Because in You and You alone is a rich and satisfying life. And so Jesus, together, just as an act of faith, we walk through You. Take that step from death to life, from sin to freedom. In Jesus' mighty and holy name, amen.